This is ContactTalkRadio.com, consciousness in action, and you are taking action into your consciousness by tuning into Contact Talk Radio.
And on TuneIn.com, Hing.fm, and Upsnap Mobile.
Contact Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Madeira Show, where he will discuss testosterone optimization and full body health for the high-performance modern man. Now, here's your host, Dr. Madeira.
Hello, everybody. It's Dr. Madeira here, back on my show today, and we have a special guest today, Sean Baker. How's it going today, Sean?
Sam's going well. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show. Spectacular to have you. For people who don't know who Sean Baker is, he is the carnivore diet expert, and he's written the book, The Carnivore Diet. So Sean Baker, MD, and you were in the Air Force, and then you got into medicine, and you were an orthopedic surgeon in New Mexico, correct?
I started in medicine in medical school, left to go play professional rugby in New Zealand. You know, when I got tired of doing that, I entered the military, and then they paid for my medical school after a stint doing nuclear weapons, and then went deployed to Afghanistan, did some trauma surgery for quite a while, then went into private practice in New Mexico, and that's kind of what I did for about two decades of my life, you know, as far as orthopedics. And then I've kind of recently switched into a more lifestyle-based approach, where it's, you know, focused on nutrition and other lifestyle aspects for improving health.
And how did you get from orthopedic surgeon to looking at the carnivore diet in a nutshell? How did that transition happen for you?
Well, it was really my own personal transition, you know, from going from metabolically unhealthy, despite being a very successful athlete, to trying to figure out what I could do outside of exercise, because I had kind of redlined the amount of exercise and training I could do. I was already competing at a world-class level, but despite that, I still was developing, you know, metabolic issues, diabetes, hypertension, sleep apnea, all those things, all those wonderful things that no one wants. And I went on about a 10-year journey on different diets, trying to see what fit best for me. And, you know, about 3.5 years ago, kind of discovered this carnivore style of eating. And, you know, since that time, I've just, you know, gotten healthier and healthier. And, you know, I've been basically thriving since then. I've been sharing it with now tens of thousands of people who have gotten, for the most part, very similar results.
Excellent. So essentially, you were able to reverse metabolic syndrome, sleep apnea, and diabetes with the carnivore diet.
Basically, yeah, that's been my personal story. I mean, as well as some kind of orthopedic, you know, aches and pains and tendonitis and a little bit of arthritis, improve body composition, improve athletic performance, improve strength. You know, pretty much it largely has been all win, which has been kind of nice.
That's spectacular. I mean, a lot of the men that I see as patients and work with have sleep apnea, they're overweight, they're looking to optimize testosterone performance in the gym, in the bedroom, and they're confused on what to eat. And there's a lot of misinformation in the media, in the news, that you do a really good job of basically saying, nope, that's not correct. There's, you know, that's not how this is working. And when we put the pedal to the metal here, and a lot of men are coming into me and saying, well, I watched this documentary, or, you know, now my wife has said we're all going to be vegan, or the husband tells my patient who's female, we're all going to be vegan or plant-based. And I'm curious what you have seen from people who were vegan, who then became carnivore diet proponents and followed that diet. What happened for them?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of people that were ex-plant-based or ex-vegan switch over the diet, you know, and the reason they make the switch is because their plant-based diet was failing them for whatever reason, whether it was digestive issues or mental health issues or, you know, just general fatigue. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why they leave that. And so generally just adding meat back to their diet seems to help, and it seems to help in a dose related fashion. And so the more you know, the more animal product, the more nutrient-dense food they put back in the diet, the better their recovery seems to be. And that happens fairly frequently. I've gotten literally thousands of former vegans now that have made the switch. And it's kind of interesting because obviously both diets, many people would consider extremes on either side. And so it's interesting when you have a kind of a, you know, almost a case comparison situation where they've done this diet and they got this result and they switch over to the other diet and they get radically better. And so it's not necessarily definitive truth that one's better than the other, but it's curious to see that that's happening. And it certainly goes against sort of the major narrative that's out there that we should all be eating more and more plants and less meat. And what I posit is that it's not meat, it's the junk food, it's the refined grains, the seed oils, the sugar-rich diet that we're on that's really making us sick. Because if we look at the American diet, as much as it's maligned, you know, red meat only makes up a few ounces a day. The average American eats about 2.4 ounces of beef per day, which is down significantly from, you know, 50 years ago in the 1970s when we ate nearly double that. So, you know, it's a tiny, tiny part of our diet, and yet we are trying to blame it for all of the misery, suffering, and disability that's occurring, which is related to nutrition. So it's kind of an interesting, wake-up call. When you eliminate all the other junk, but you just have meat in the diet, what actually happens? And that's the best, it might be that's really the best way to test out if meat is good or bad. You know, I mean, what happens if you only eat it? Then, you know, if it's bad, you should get really, really sick. If it's not bad, then, you know, maybe you don't get sick. And I think that's what we're seeing pretty clearly day in and day out.
Yeah, it definitely makes a strong argument for that, that meat is not the devil here and the one to blame for, you know, a lot of what the dogma of nutrition has been is that, you know, fat is evil and meat is bad, red meat, especially red meat. And a lot of the marketing I remember in the 80s and 90s was around margarine, which trans fats, and white meat, you know, the commercials, the other white meat and stuff like that. So what is your take on this political spin, or basically this propaganda spin from the vegan camp around them saying that greenhouse gases are caused by us having farms with cows and livestock, and that leading to this global warming or climate change, as they're saying, that is like one of the biggest reasons they're positing that we have climate change?
Well, I mean, that is not in alignment with any major organization that studies climate change. You know, the EPA publishes data in the U.S. on where our greenhouse gases come from. You know, FAO, the IPCC, which looks at this, all have said it's not cows are the major drivers of greenhouse gases. I mean, if we are going to make an argument that there is an anthropogenic source of greenhouse gases or man-made source of greenhouse gases, that is clearly derived from fossil fuels. You know, animal agriculture in the United States represents 5% of our greenhouse gases. Cows represent about 2%. Plant agriculture represents 5%. So, I mean, if we're going to, the agriculture sector entirely is only 9%. You know, our transportation sector, energy sector, and industry sector make up about 80% of our greenhouse gases via things like fossil fuels. And so it's wildly blown out of proportion, you know. And in fact, when we look at methane, which is a major greenhouse gas cows emit through their belching, we find that as we look at it more and more, and this is data from 2006, Livestock's Long Shadow. And since that time, not only have the estimates been downgraded by the initial authors, initially they wanted to say 18% of greenhouse gases worldwide were attributed to cows. And this is life cycle assessment. Remember, this is not just how much they're actually belching. It's every single aspect that goes into creating a kilogram of meat. That comparison was not done for automobiles or transportation. They didn't do any life cycle assessments. They only did pure emissions. And so if we were to look at pure emissions, worldwide, animal agriculture only puts out about 5% of our worldwide emissions. Cows are probably, you know, 3% worldwide emissions. And so it's really actually a much smaller number than they talk about. And even now we're finding out that more and more sources of methane, which are being discovered, which hadn't been previously accounted, are making that number look even smaller and smaller. And then we also have to remember that the methane that cows emit, it goes into the natural carbon cycle. And so it's in a very short time frame in residence in the atmosphere relative to CO2 from fossil fuels, which stay up there for thousands of years. Whereas, you know, methane from cows is up there, not even 1% as long. So it's rapidly turned over and recycled. In fact, the number of cows on the planet has decreased by about 100 million in the last 30 years, and yet methane numbers have gone up. And so it makes zero sense to say that cows that have gotten less in number are causing greater amounts of methane in the air. That's because things like fracking, things like hydroelectric power, natural gas, and other sources, which we didn't even know, are now turning out to be major drivers of methane. So it's a very politicized argument. It is a very, very much a misrepresentation of the actual data that's out there. And that doesn't even include soil carbon offsets, which clearly, as more and more research is looking into this, particularly in farmers and ranchers that are doing adaptive multi-paddock grazing, which is becoming more and more popular, we're seeing that the soil carbon deposition is offsetting a lot of the methane emissions to where it's becoming almost a non-factor. And in fact, there are new estimates out there from guys like Alan Williams, who's a PhD and does some of the soil science, that if we could convert, in the United States, maybe 40% of our grazing management to a regenerative style. Currently we're at 5%, but if we could convert 40% of our animals that way, we would completely mitigate all greenhouse gases from all sectors in the United States, which is just a huge statement. So that is, really the way forward. It's not the plant-based diet, which would leave people both malnourished, and the soil's worse. Soil degradation would be worse. Our planet would be worse for it, and our population would be worse for it. So the vegan solution is not a solution. It's a real problem, actually.
Yeah, thanks for that detailed, basically summary of the falsehoods and the truths there. One thing that has struck me about essentially the plant-based folks versus the non-plant-based is that, I have a clinic in Seattle and I have a clinic in Montana, and people in Montana have ranches, they have farms, they hunt. They're arguably, definitely more connected with their environment, whether they're farming, ranching, hiking, skiing, backcountry skiing, hunting. And people in the cities seem to be, especially on the West Coast, more into, being convinced by documentaries on what to eat. And they're not as connected to their environment. They're not as connected to, growing food or where cows come from or where meat comes from and the whole process around that. Are you seeing this in your audience as well? Or is there a more... less black and white, because obviously my example is very black and white.
Yeah, well, I've got a fairly diverse sort of audience or following. There's certainly a distancing from most people, and the people who live in urban centers, maybe live in an apartment or a small, a crowded neighborhood. They don't have any sort of insight into how food is produced, where it comes from, how it's grown, or they think it comes in a box in a grocery store. A lot of these folks, they have no idea. And certainly the people that have been around it, that understand it, grow up with it, appreciate it more. They realize the work that goes in, the sacrifice that goes in, the care that the people that produce our food actually have. This is a thing, when people talk about animal welfare and not animal rights, because they're different. Animal welfare means taking care of your animals, making sure they're not mistreated, sick, or, in pain or suffering. Whereas animal rights is you want to elevate them to give them some status that, you know, it's arguable that they deserve. This is a very different understanding. You know, people that, you know, they're the closest they've come to being around wild animals or domestic animals that we produce for food is maybe a Disney cartoon, or they have a pet dog and they think that, you know, all animals are like your pet dog. And that's very much not the same. Not many people have pet cows, you know.
It's right.
It's just a very different dynamic. And we have to understand that these animals have a purpose, and whether it's in the wild or in the domestic system that we've made so that we don't have to hunt animals in the wild anymore. I mean, this was done to feed, you know, the masses of population that have grown. So yeah, there's definitely a dichotomy in people's understanding about where their food comes from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely what I see. It obviously, like you said, your audience is very diverse. As far as what the carnivore diet is and what the carnivore diet is not, besides obviously eating meat, what does the carnivore diet mean to you and or entail to you if somebody is listening to this right now and are thinking, okay, well, what do I eat? Do I just eat steak every day? What do you eat? What do you recommend people start with if they're going to start this out at home?
Yeah, I mean, the way I describe the diet, you know, and of course I've written a book called The Carnivore Diet, but I really say, you know, the diet focuses on animal products. I mean, this is where your nutrition comes from. And then the plants, you know, they are dialed down, up or down as tolerated, you know, and I, you know, for some people it's complete elimination. There's some people out there that they literally have to exclude all plant material from their diet to fix whatever issue they're dealing with, whether it's an autoimmune issue, a gut issue like Crohn's disease, or some sort of mental health issue. I mean, these people are out there and they exist. And this does seem to be an effective tool. And there's a number of reasons why that may go on. But like I said, I'm not doing this in a dogmatic or a zealous way. I think there's people that can eat a diet that's, you know, 90% meat, and they can include 10% of vegetables, fruit, whatever they, you know, whatever works for them. And again, it's about seeing what actually works and being objective about it, not just, you know, blindly adhering to this is the only way you can eat type of thing. And so that's how I kind of define it. Now, my personal diet, you know, I eat a lot of red meat. I mean, most of my diet's red meat. You know, currently I'm eating a little more fish in my diet just because I'm, you know, like we talked about off the record a minute ago, I'm getting a little leaner for a different sport. I'm getting lighter, so I'm, you know, just eating a little bit leaner cuts of meat. But many people find they do well on the fattier cuts of meat, the ribeyes, the short ribs, the, you know, the skirt steaks, and so on and so forth. I put some seasoning on my food. I tolerate it fine. I mean, some people don't do well with seasonings. I do fine with that, depending on what they are. So, I mean, that's kind of my diet. I mean, occasionally I'll have a little bit of dairy, but it's pretty infrequent for me. I tend to do better when I limit dairy. Beyond that, you know, I don't really stray much. You know, every once in a while, like I said, I think the last time I had, when was it? In June, last June, I guess it's been almost a year. I had a little piece of birthday cake that my daughter had, you know, and that was, you know, it's not a big deal. I was fine. I didn't get sick. I mean, I had one the year before and I didn't do so well. Like I kind of didn't feel good afterwards, but this one I did fine. So, I mean, I just, you know, I don't get those cravings for all these food, you know, very frequently at all, if ever, which is very nice. It's very liberating. I enjoy my food very much. I very much, you know, I had three fillets for lunch and six pieces of fish. I mean, you know, six pieces of flounder for lunch today. And that probably will be my only meal today. I might have some bone broth a little bit later, because like I said, I'm trying to lean out. That's, you know, that's about, you know, when it all comes said and done, it's maybe 2,500 calories, which is a little bit light for me, but that is, you know, that's what I'm eating as of today.
Okay. And does that include organ meats?
I don't eat them. I, you know, like I said, I've had, well, I mean, I shouldn't say I don't intentionally not eat them, but I don't really enjoy them very much. So I don't really find them to be necessary. I don't really find them to provide anything additionally beneficial to me. I mean, I've had them occasionally, you know, when they were offered to me. I've had some organ meat that was blended Emmy ground beef. I've had some, you know, liverwurst, Braunschweiger, some of these sausages once in a while, but I don't go out of my way to eat organ meats. I think, you know, I mean, I've literally interacted with tens of thousands of people, and I've asked them and polled them and done surveys, and about 15% of the people on the diet include organ meats with any sort of frequency. And that would be, you know, once a week or more. So the vast majority of people aren't eating them to any significant amount. I know some people disagree with that approach, but that's just what, you know, what the results have been, and the people have actually done it and done it the longest. So the organ meats seem to be, for some people, quite beneficial, but I'm not saying that all people need to do it to be successful in the diet, because that's clearly not the case.
Okay, that makes sense to me. Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of the organ meats myself either. I think maybe some other cultures are more well-versed, or people's grandparents or great-grandparents knew how to cook those better than I do. As far as your athletic performance, I mean, you're an athlete. You've competed as a rower. And how have you noticed your performance change from switching to the carnivore diet years ago to now?
Yeah, several things. So, I mean, you know, like I said, my most recent sport has been rowing, for which I've, you know, won a world championship and set several world records, and got significantly better, about 10%, which I thought was a huge improvement. You know, when I was already at a, you know, world-class level, to improve another 10% is actually pretty darn good. My strength went up significantly. My recovery went up significantly. I sleep better. You know, as a guy who's in his 50s now, the lack of aches and pains and inflammation and joint swelling and joint inflammation and my, you know, tendonitis and those types of things completely being gone makes it a lot easier for me to train, makes me more, you know, willing to train. You know, when your knee hurts, you don't really feel like squatting, but now, because I don't have those aches and pains, I'm able to train, you know, at a pretty high intensity. And I'm able to train pretty much every single day without ever having to need to take a day off. I mean, I'll take a day off every once in a while if my body lets me know. But, I mean, most days, I'd say 9 times out of 10, I'm training. And, you know, if schedule or the occasional period of time where I just, you know, feel like I need a break, I'll take a break. But recovery's been phenomenal. You know, strength has been great. Performance has been great. Everything has improved from an athletic standpoint, without a doubt.
Spectacular. That's very convincing. I have a brother who is an athlete and college athlete, and I don't know if he'll listen to this, but maybe this could benefit him and his friends and other people who are athletes or even the weekend warrior. Are you noticing who this diet might not be for, or if there are any contraindications, medical or otherwise?
There is, you know, I think we all, you know, well, let me just put a couple caveats here. I think all healthy human beings have the capacity to do well on meat. I mean, that's kind of why we evolved, quite honestly. I think there are certainly some people where cost prohibitive, particularly depending on what country you're in. I think there's a few people that may have to do it a little bit differently. You know, some people will thrive on a high fat approach. Some people have to do a less fat, you know, a lesser fat approach. Some people that, you know, I would say that people that have, really poor stomach acid will have a harder time. And this happens a lot of times to older folks. And that's, some people say it's a product of aging, but I think that's just a product of disease. You know, it's just disease manifestation. I think that, you know, like if you just recently had a heart attack and you're particularly inflamed and you have, you know, a lot of, you know, vascular inflammation and you have this sort of milieu that sets you up for a heart attack, then going into a high fat diet initially might be something to keep an eye on, just because when we talk about cholesterol, I think that, you know, cholesterol certainly has a role in atherosclerotic disease. The question is, you know, does it mostly manifest itself in people that are otherwise metabolically compromised? And that being, you know, do they have endothelial damage? Do they have vascular inflammation? Do they have problems with insulin regulation or you know, diabetic pathophysiology. And I think clearly those people, which is unfortunately a large segment of our population, some studies would suggest up to 88% of our American population fits in that category. And so those people, elevations in cholesterol might be problematic. Now, does this diet always elevate cholesterol? No. Some people it does, some people it doesn't. So I think you just have to be mindful of that. So it might make sense, you know, to pursue a diet where you're not eating quite as much fat initially. And so that until those other, you know, metabolic factors sort of regulate. And we do see this pretty consistently. Most people, they go on this carnivore diet, see their insulin levels, you know, go down to a really small level. They see inflammatory markers drop pretty precipitously. Things like C-reactive protein, IL-6, tumor necrosis factor, all those things tend to fall pretty reliably on a carnivorous diet. Blood glucose seems to normalize. So once those things start to occur, you know, then I think you become safer and safer to eat, you know, eat a little bit higher fat diet.
And does this also include, on the similar note of metabolic syndrome and everything, fasting and intermittent fasting is very popular today. Do you include intermittent fasting in your routines now, or fasting?
I do a lot of what I would call physiologic fasting. And so I think, you know, when I hear about a fasting protocol, that usually indicates a prescribed time and frequency. And I think that's, you know, that can be fine. A lot of people do well and thrive on that. And they get this, they have the external feedback that kind of helps them out. I find that, you know, the diet itself sort of does that automatically. And so generally I'll eat once or twice a day, and that's almost always based upon appetite, you know, particularly when I'm sort of at a maintenance level where I'm just kind of, you know, sitting there and eating my fill and, you know, eating when hungry. And I think that works for most people on this diet, just because, you know, when we look at satiety is very good. Satiety is very high from protein and fat. And, you know, whether it's through stimulation of CCK, peptide YY, you know, leptin, or some of these other hormones that have roles on appetite regulation, meat seems to act favorably in all of those. And so I find that, you know, I just don't want to eat that frequently. I don't need to snack like when you're eating maybe a carbohydrate-based diet where you're, you know, you're often eating, you know, 5 to 8 times a day, you know, 16 hours a day you're grazing. So I like I said, we do a lot of physiologic fasting. I've experimented a little bit with longer fasting just as experiments, but I don't generally employ that regularly. I don't really need to. In my particular situation, it's because I'm already pretty lean. I'm athletic. You know, I train quite a bit. So it's sort of, you know, particularly extended fasting, I think it doesn't really necessarily help those things that much. I think for other people that are metabolically challenged and struggle with obesity, those external cues can be helpful.
Yeah, definitely. That makes sense to me, especially for the athletes listening like yourself. Around the whole fasting scenarios. As far as genetics, like the ApoE genotype, patients that may have ApoE genotype 4 or 3-4 or 4-4, which predisposes people to things like Parkinson's disease and heart attack, stroke, in the way that they deal with saturated fats. Have you seen anybody report to you or message you that has this genotype and that they're on the carnivore diet and their lipid panels are looking good as far as, you know, within normal limits, so to speak?
Yeah, I've seen several people ApoE4 positive, you know, and the concern particularly around dementia. Probably, you know, when it comes to prevention of Alzheimer's disease, probably the best thing we can do, at least based on my understanding, is mitigate hyperinsulinemia. This diet does a pretty darn good job of that. But yeah, I've seen people, you know, really with all different types of, you know, genotypes when it comes to that, you know, have either normal looking lipids or sometimes high LDLs, you know, just kind of, you know, I don't know that I can see an exact pattern there. There's some people that believe there's this phenomenon called the lean mass hyperresponder. There's a guy named Dave Feldman, who's an engineer, who's been looking at this for a number of years now. And typically we'll see people elevated LDL, but they have very high HDL. They have very, very low triglycerides. They tend to be very lean. And all other factors that would be risk factors for cardiometabolic disease, you know, such as, you know, high blood pressure or other things, or hyperinsulinemia, are all normal. So I think, you know, as far as that particular phenotype goes, or genotype rather, I think, you know, controlling insulin probably makes the most sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I've been reading Dr. Bredesen's book, The Bredesen mm-hmm. Protocol, and he echoes that from his research and insulin being one of the main concerns, elevation of insulin, and also robs men of testosterone, which a lot of men are concerned about when they come in to see me and my colleagues, you know, what's going on with my testosterone. Maybe they have some early signs of, maybe they already have high cholesterol or high insulin or both, or unknown. But we do see insulin also causing things like prostate cancer, or at least I shouldn't say causing, but predisposing people to higher risk for prostate cancer, men, obviously. So with that said, more specifically, we had a question from one of this men's only Facebook group that I started a while back now, and there are men in there all over the world. One of the men in there asked what happens to hepatic insulin sensitivity when someone's been on the carnivore diet greater than 6 months.
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know that we know 100% for sure. I mean, you know, hepatic insulin sensitivity mirrors, you know, insulin sensitivity in other parts of the body. There is some thought, and theory about specificity of insulin resistance, whether, you know, differentially impacted the liver versus the muscles being about 80% of our glucose disposal, but the liver being a hugely important organ with blood glucose stability. You know, the hepatic gluconeogenesis is something that can, you know, be part of the diabetic pathophysiology. My experience with this is that for most people, you know, it's hard to assess hepatic, you know, insulin sensitivity without some specialized testing. I mean, you can look at by proxy fatty liver. You can look at, you know, things like, you know, in a non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and some of the liver enzymes, which occasionally are bumped with that. I mean, the liver enzymes aren't necessarily the best measure, but they can certainly, if they're very, very low, it makes it less likely. And for the most part, I've seen low liver enzymes. Here's what I think about diabetic pathophysiology that I think is important, an important concept. When we talk about what is the sort of underlying problem that's going on, a lot of people, you know, the old school thought was, well, diabetes just means elevated blood glucose, and we define it, you know, we've got this, you know, this sort of cutoff fasting blood glucose above 126, or, you know, you see a postprandial number, a random number above 200. That's kind of old thinking. And then there's people that now say, well, it's all about insulin. You know, it's what's our insulin level looking at? And they'll talk about a sort of a postprandial insulin response. And then there are other people who will talk about, no, it's about fat deposits within different tissues, whether it's muscle or, you know, pancreas or liver, or they call so-called ectopic fat. And there's some truth to that as well. And the fact that, you know, if we have an accumulation of fat in the muscle tissue, the myocytes, or in the, you know, the liver cells or the pancreas, then we can often see insulin resistance. However, many athletes will have fat, particularly triglycerides, in the muscle, and they don't have insulin resistance. So there's this little bit of an athlete's paradox there. But when we look specifically at what types of fats, we see things like ceramides and diacylglycerides. And we think that, you know, that comes from possibly things like palmitic acid, which is a saturated fat. And a lot of people in the plant-based community says, aha, saturated fat is driving fat into the muscle tissue, and therefore being the cause of insulin resistance. What they don't tell you is that palmitic acid is generally made in the liver through something called de novo lipogenesis. And that de novo lipogenesis just can occur in response to a number of things. It could be to fructose exposure. It could be to, you know, carbohydrate exposure. It could be to fat exposure. I mean, basically what's happening is the liver is taking those inputs, you know, breaking down into acetyl-CoA and then rebuilding these molecules and making this saturated fat called palmitic acid. So it's actually synthesized palmitic acid in the bloodstream that's leading to some of these issues. Now, even more in depth than that, there's a thought that it's due to mitochondrial overload. And what's happening is the mitochondria sees more energy than it can deal with, quite frankly. Then what happens is you have this incomplete oxidation of these fats, and you get these intermediates that kind of accumulate. And this is where we get these ceramides, these diacylglycerides. And so really what happens is if you overeat, and you can overeat on any diet, including a carnivore diet. So if you take in more energy, and I know this sounds like a calorie balance argument, but there is some truth to that. If you take in more than your body can use or need, you will accumulate these metabolic intermediates that will, you know, end up in our tissues. Ectopic fat will develop, and then we'll develop insulin resistance because these ectopic fats interfere with things like serine kinase and some of these other insulin receptor intermediates. And so it's probably more complex than that. You know, I mean, well, it is. It's just there's a lot more things that go into it, but that's kind of the overview there. So it's not just specifically a carnivore diet. It's any diet in which you overeat. And the nice thing about a carnivore diet is because of the protein content, because of the decreased carbohydrate content, you probably can get away with eating more food than you could on another diet before you run into those issues. So it's not that it's a get out of jail free card, but it just gives you more wiggle room.
Yeah, that makes sense to me as far as the kind of like metabolic overload that you're referencing there in great detail. Thanks for that answer. The other question that we had come through from that group, there are a couple other ones, but one is specific to testosterone levels and whether for people that have messaged you or yourself, if you have any measurement of free testosterone levels, bioavailable testosterone levels, before and after a carnivore diet, have you seen a uptick in men's testosterone levels while doing this diet?
I've seen kind of a little bit of everything. I mean, I've seen some people where their testosterone level goes up, some of it goes down, some of it doesn't change. I mean, really, I think when we have to realize that just like insulin, just like thyroid, just like many other hormones, there is a hormone and there is a receptor. And both of those have a role in what we consider testosterone function. You know, and what we're really interested is in clinical function. So that is, you know, as a man, it's, you know, spontaneous erections, morning erections, it's libido, it's muscle, it's, you know, being lean, it's cognition, all the things that we use testosterone for are its clinical function. And so whether your level, you know, your free testosterone level is, you know, whatever it is versus, you know, twice as much, doesn't matter as much as the overall balance between the receptor density and the receptor sensitivity and the amount of circulating hormone. In fact, Stuart Phillips, 2018, did a really nice paper looking at athletes, male athletes, and their capacity to put on muscle with regard to hormone levels. And it was free, bound, you know, sex hormone, binding globulin, you know, total testosterone, and a few other hormones. And the only factor they found that reliably predicted the ability to gain muscle with resistance training was androgen receptor density. And so now we see this interest in selective androgen receptor modulators, which is kind of, you know, addressing the same thing I talked about. It's, you know, both the level in the blood plus what's there as a receptor. Now, this works in the natural athlete. This works in a non-supplemented guy. So if you have, you know, if you don't take drugs, you're not taking steroids, you're not taking exogenous testosterone, if you're testosterone level is lower or higher, it doesn't matter as much depending upon what your androgen receptor level is. You know, we're looking at the clinical function. I could care less what my testosterone is if I can't get it up. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's 1,000 or 300. I don't really care. I want to have the outcome, you know, the clinical function there. And so the diet seems to be unpredictable in what it does. But I will tell you that most people do notice an improvement in the clinical function. Most guys, you know, whether they're in their 30s, 40s, 50s, or 60s will say, I'm having spontaneous morning erections again. I'm waking up every day with an erection, which is a very, very good sign in my view, as far as, you know, what's going on clinically. So that's what I've observed. Not directly, just by report. By
right. Yeah. Well, that's spectacular news that, you know, you're getting those reports anecdotally from people that are noticing spontaneous erections. And usually what I tell people in the men's group on Facebook on is that, you know, if you're not getting morning erections, then something's going on. And like you said, there's a lot to it. It's not just your blood level of testosterone or, you know, people are measuring the hormone in saliva or urine. It's not just that level. It's, you know, the utility of the hormone in the body and the insulin that you just discussed before this question that in detail. So, yeah, that's good to hear because, honestly, I couldn't even really watch much of that documentary that came out. I think it was last year, 2019. But they were saying in, I think it was Game Changers, that the plant-based diet was improving erections for male athletes or something like that, or men in general. And, you know, I don't have a, you know, I'm not a research scientist, so I don't research nutrition on my patients and I don't use them as nutrition research subjects, but I haven't seen the vegan diet do that and I haven't seen it turn out very well for people. What I do see is kind of what you're talking about on a bigger scale in the whole country of the US is that people are more metabolically unsound and still have metabolic syndrome on the plant-based diet. So it's good to hear that the carnivore diet is doing the opposite because of what their proposal was, is that their diet was better, which we know that documentary was great propaganda for somebody's pea protein powder. So anyway, moving right along, another question came through about glycogen and muscles on the carnivore diet. Since the dogma of being on carbs to restore muscle glycogen, and what, as an athlete, you could speak to this, what have you noticed when you switched over, if you can remember the difference in maybe recovery or some other things you may have noticed?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I mean, carbohydrates are well known for restoring glycogen. There's no doubt that they do that, and they do that very effectively and efficiently. What we do see, and we've got both animal and human data on this, that shows that if protein is adequate, and this is the difference between a standard ketogenic diet and a carnivore diet, is that when you eat a higher protein diet, and a carnivore diet certainly is a higher protein diet for the most part for most people, gluconeogenesis is upregulated somewhat. We see that hepatic glycogen stores tend to fill up overnight. I think the muscle glycogen tends to fill up as well. We tend to utilize less glycogen when we exercise in higher and higher intensities. And so glycogen really has not been a big issue in my experience for what I do now. The caveat I would throw in with that is if you are an athlete, say you are an athlete that's training for, you know, multiple times throughout the day or for extremely strong, long events, you might get into a little bit of an issue with that. But for the average athlete training once a day, you know, there's no problem at all. And I mean, right now I'm doing 2-a-day workouts and I'm doing a pretty intense, you know, 8,000 meter row, 10,000 meter row, 15,000 meter row, which is, you know, anywhere between half an hour to an hour of, you know, pretty intense, you know, aerobic activity in the morning and not taking any carbs and able to have a really good weightlifting session in the afternoon. So I've been able to do this. I'm adapted to it for a period of time. Sometimes that adaptation process can take a while, up to 6 months for some athletes. I do consultations with a lot of real high level athletes, and some of them, you know, initially we have them use a quick acting carb source, either inter-workout or immediately pre-workout. And then many of them find they can taper that off or reserve it for only very, very rare occasions when they really have a, you know, really high gear they have to hit. But, you know, for the most part, you know, if you're getting adequate protein, those glycogen stores tend to be pretty well topped off.
That's good to hear. And on that note, do you, for athletes or anybody on the carnivore diet, are people taking any supplements while on the diet? Are they supplementing any nutrients that you've heard of?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, and it's very, very much different people doing different things. I think one of the more common things people will do is take electrolytes. You know, this is something that pretty much most low carbohydrate diets, people find that, you know, particularly early on during the transition phase, as we drop our insulin levels, we see that we hang on to less fluid, we hang on to less sodium and less water. And so sometimes, you know, when you become relatively, I guess a relative dehydration occurs, some people will say that's just normal and that we're maybe otherwise too hydrated. And that's why a lot of times we see people's blood pressure drop when they go on a carnivore diet, because they're not, maybe not overloaded with fluid. But for performance, you know, it seems like, well, it doesn't seem, there's pretty good data that shows that as we're better hydrated, we can perform certain activities better athletically. You know, our muscles fill up with fluid. We get that quote unquote pump that a lot of people like, particularly guys in the bodybuilding or weightlifting communities, like their muscles to feel fuller. And so kind of to sort of hack that loss of fluid and electrolytes, a lot of people will consume fluid and electrolytes prior to training, you know, maybe 20 minutes prior to a workout. They'll take some salt and some water, and then they'll use that, and then they'll get the same effect as they would with carbohydrates as far as that fluid balance goes. Some people will supplement vitamin D, some people supplement vitamin C, some people will include organ meats to get those nutrients. It's kind of a mixed bag. I would say the majority of the people that do it don't really do much supplementing. And if they do, it's probably only electrolytes. So generally, no, I don't personally do any supplements outside of, like I said, I'll occasionally do some electrolytes for training, but that's about it for me.
Yeah, that's good to know. Yeah, I was curious about that, because with other diets and, you know, a lot, you know, being a naturopathic doctor, we use nutritional supplements sometimes for patients when their labs may show that they might be deficient in something. But with meat, you get your B vitamins, B12. So there's less chance that you're going to need to supplement as much as maybe somebody who's on a more other side of the spectrum with plant-based, because you don't have iron deficiency issues or issues with things like choline, et cetera. As you mentioned a lot in your post on Instagram, we had another question from the group. Somebody was asking about how people are dealing with the high fats and specifically how they're digesting them. Are they doing anything for their gallbladder and helping move the bile and stuff like that? And if you've heard of anybody who've had any issues with digesting the fat specifically?
Yeah, certainly some people will have a hard time with fat. And I think, you know, when we, you know, a lot of people have gallbladder issues and they are used to a low fat diet. And so I think like anything, you know, you sort of become adapted to what you do. And if you're not used to eating a higher fat diet, then fat can be difficult to digest initially. And so some people will develop nausea. Some people won't absorb as much, and so they'll have steatorrhea, which is, you know, fat in their stool. That's something that generally improves over time. Some people do find that supplements, digestive supplements can help, things like lipases, and some people will add some bile, you know, bile supplements to that, although that can sometimes just be more fat to the system if they don't absorb anyway. But that is not an uncommon problem. It seems that maybe it happens more often than not in women, because women tend to sort of steer towards a more salad-based, low-fat diets initially. And so I think they initially have a harder time. But for most people, it's a transient thing. I do think that is a good point, though. I mean, there's some people that, you know, they come from a ketogenic background where they feel that they have to eat just a lot of fat. You know, they have to always eat a lot of fat. And I'm not sure that I agree with that in all situations. I think that some people, you have to get adequate fat, and adequate fat doesn't always mean a lot of fat, you know? And so you kind of find a balance level that works, because if you go too low fat, then you run into problems with hormone issues. You run into problems with just cell membrane issues. You know, we've got, you know, fat is essential for a reason. We need to take it into our diet, but there's a point where, you know, you get, you know, more than you actually need. Again, this all goes to this energy overload, fat overload type situation. And so I think people will find their own balance with time. It may take, you know, it may take a few months to kind of figure that out though.
So with that said, you would say that you're not in the camp of a ketogenic diet. So if somebody is going to do a carnivore version of the diet, you're not ketogenic carnivore is what you're trying to get at there as well, right?
Well, not necessarily. Again, I think it has to be sort of tailored a little bit to the person and to the individual at the time. I think anybody that's got goals of competing as an athlete, I think protein has to be the predominant macronutrient, whether it's per gram or per calorie. I think there's a minimal protein you need to get. I think that's pretty clear to me. I think that the fat is invariable. Some people will do better on a higher fat approach. Some people don't. And I think it, this is something you have to figure. Some people are up hitting ketogenic macronutrient ratios. And depending on what you're treating, you know, some people with that are using this diet to, you know, mitigate or sort of manage cancer and some of these other diseases, do a higher fat approach, and it seems to work for them. You know, for me personally, you know, as an athlete, as someone who is interested in maintaining lean muscle mass and having as much lean muscle mass as possible, I tend to gravitate to a higher protein approach. But that doesn't necessarily mean everyone needs to do it that way.
Okay, so work with the individual is what I'm hearing there. And as far as raw meat, I've seen some people be proponents of having raw meat before athletic events or just in general while on the carnivore diet. And what are your thoughts on that if people are doing this?
Well, I mean, I'm not opposed to raw meat. I think that, you know, people have been eating raw meat forever. I mean, you know, since humans came about, we started out eating raw meat before we learned how to cook. And there's still societies that eat raw meat every day. And, you know, things, dishes like steak tartare and beef carpaccio and others are basically raw meat that's eaten all around the world. So I do think you have to be careful with salt sourcing. I do think contamination is a very real and significant risk for people. So you can get, and I've seen people get sick from doing it, and some cases very sick. So I like, you know, for things like steak, I mean, if you like the rare or raw, maybe just quick sear on both sides just to kill any surface bacteria that might be there. And then you can, you know, the inside's probably fine. So outside of, you know, the small risk of contamination, the small but very real and potentially very morbid risk, it can be fine.
Okay. And on the similar note, somebody had a question around raw meat, and if people are eating raw meat, are they doing anything for anti-parasitic measures to take precautions around that? I think when you were mentioning contamination, you were mentioning more like bacterial contamination. Is that correct?
That's simply, yeah, for that. For parasites, some people will advocate, you know, freezing the meat first. I know that will kill many parasites if it's frozen ahead of time. So that might be an option. Beyond that, I'm not aware of anything that people are doing outside. I mean, there's anti-parasitics you can take, or medications, but that's not practical to do that every time you eat, obviously. So, you know, and again, it depends on the country you're in. I think most of the, you know, meat raised in the U.S., most of the animals are given anti-parasitics, you know, during the production. So they tend not to have parasites. You know, other countries where, you know, third world countries and places where the animal agriculture isn't so well regulated, you might run into more problems with parasites in the meat.
Okay, that's helpful. And as far going back to the bone broth or bone broths, you said today you're going to have a bone broth. Do you ever do like a whole 3-day bone broth fast or when you're not training as heavily? Or what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I haven't personally done that. I mean, I've done 48 hours fasting at one point just as a kind of an experiment. I think that can be, you know, I certainly, you know, when it comes to fasting and extended fasting, I do think they have a utility in that. In fact, I've done quite a bit of research into that. I do think that, you know, avoiding dehydration is important. Bone broth can be a good strategy for that. So I think that's fine. You know, there's other ways, you know, to get fluid and electrolytes as well. I mean, I think if you're going to, you know, make sure you get both fluid and electrolytes during those times. And the dry fasting, I'm not as much of a proponent of for any, you know, any kind of long period of time. I think that you can get into trouble with dehydration. I think that, you know, fasting in general can be helpful for many people. You just have to be somewhat cautious depending on who the actual person is. You know, certain diabetics will have issues, particularly if they're on drugs like insulin or sulfonylureas, where, you know, they have significant risk for hypoglycemia. So, but other than that, you know, I think it's fine. I mean, I think it's fine. And I think, you know, like I said, it helps. It clearly does help people. There's some pretty good research going out showing that fasting can improve diabetic blood sugar numbers. It can improve obesity, at least to the degree of calorie restriction, if not better, depending on how it's done. I think that perhaps a good strategy when it comes to fasting is to kind of be somewhat variable and you know, kind of give your body different looks. You know, I think your body adapts. So if you're doing once a day, every single day, over and over and again, your body kind of adapts to that, and we will see a little bit of a metabolic slowdown. So I think throwing some curveballs in there, so maybe eating, you know, normal meals for a couple of days and then going a 36-hour fast or a 48-hour fast kind of unpredictably and randomly is going to give you more results than just hammering the same sort of, you know, pattern over and over and over again. That tends to, your body kind of adapts to that and makes its adjustments, whether it decreases, you know, heat generation or slows other metabolic processes down, it will adapt to it. So.
Yeah, that makes sense to me as far as the bone broth fasting. What I'm curious about, because I've mentioned this diet, I believe it was last summer to somebody here in Montana, and they were wondering about how that could be affordable for somebody who maybe doesn't eat a lot of meat right now because meat is expensive where they live. Do you have any places that you prefer to order your meat from, or basically ways around that for people?
Well, I mean, the best way around it is to buy and, you know, get a chest freezer and just order a side of beef or a half a beef or a quarter beef from a rancher. I mean, you can get it for, you know, reasonably $5-6 a pound for, you know, some high quality cuts of meat. That can even include grass finished beef if you're into that. You know, ground beef and eggs can be very, very affordable. I consistently see ground beef in the grocery store for $3 a pound. You know, eggs are cheap. You find that not spending the money on all the other junk, you know, the supplements, the protein powders, the, you know, the fruit and the vegetables that rot and going in the garbage can, you quickly find that it actually is less expensive than you think. And you'll find that you end up, many people spend the same amount or in many cases less. You know, a lot of people, you could do this diet on, you know, for, you know, $5 a day, you know, for most people. And that's usually within the realm of most people's budget.
Yeah, that's very affordable. It does seem like people are buying a lot of junk, so to speak. And, you know, we're recording this in April, middle of April 2020, during the COVID-19 pandemic. And, you know, when you go into the grocery stores around you, you can see what people are buying most of, because those shelves are empty and most of it isn't the healthiest stuff in the store. Even if the person isn't eating meat. So, with that said, do you have any other recommendations for people who are interested in trying this? If, you know, they listen to this podcast and then they go to their grocery store, they split a half a cow with a friend and get a chest freezer. How do you recommend people approach this? Just by cooking steaks and, you know, doing slowly eating more meat every day, or going 100% cold turkey on the vegetables and fruits and carbs?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of depends on the person, on what their background is. You know, you can taper into it. You can taper off fiber. You can taper off carbohydrates. You can taper off something called oxalates. You know, I talk about it a little bit in the book. We've got a website called meatrx.com. So it's like meat prescription or meatrx.com. And we've got just so many resources, support groups, meetings, live meetings. I'm on there every day live. We have coaching that's super affordable. I mean, it's like $18 for a 30-minute coaching session. I mean, we've got this ridiculously great resource for people wanting to do this. An FAQ, we've got all kinds of videos. We've got all kinds of sources for meat, discounts on meat. Those things are there for people if they want to use it. So that's probably my recommendation. If you want to get started, go head over to MeaterX.com and find that out. As far as what I talk about when I interact with people, I basically say, look, what's our goal here? And some people will say, well, I want to lose 20 pounds, or I've got psoriasis or rheumatoid arthritis or something I'd like to try to maybe help with the diet. I really talk to people about relationships with food, because I think that has to be the first step. And I think the first step is, even people that are obese are suffering from malnutrition. That is to say, they've been eating maybe a lot of calories, but they haven't been eating a lot of nutrition. They're kind of maybe lacking from certain micronutrients, or even protein in general, or essential fats, and just been eating the wrong kind of fats, a lot of carbohydrate and sugar, which is all non-essential stuff. Getting that fixed and turned around, and really nourishing their bodies, and getting so they have actual satiation from food, and not just how much can I stretch my stomach out, but actually getting nutrient satiation, which is different than this mechanoreceptor satiation you get from loading up on fiber and filler. When you actually are stimulating CCK or peptide YY or leptin or any of those things, we have this true satiation occurring. And once you start having that happen on a regular basis, you don't need the other crap. You don't need the cupcakes. I tell people, eat enough food, eat enough meat so that you don't want cupcakes. I mean, that's how much you should eat to start with. And then once you kind of get through that phase, which may last, a few months, maybe 6 months, then you're ready to, kind of branch out and do intermittent fasting and play with the different macronutrient ratios and exercise a certain way and all those types of things. And again, this has to do with most people that are coming from a sedentary, overweight background where they're suffering from, sore joints and low libido and low ambition and low energy and the standard stuff we see in people as they get past 30 and 40. That's step one, is to change that relationship with food. And once you get there, your body will start to feel good, and then you'll start to really, turn the corner, and then it becomes this positive feedback loop where you just get better and better and better, and you want to do more, and you feel better, and you do more and more, and it kind of turns into a good, sort of a good situation.
Thank you. Yeah, that's very helpful. And I'm curious how you're planning on changing your version of the carnivore diet now to you were mentioning earlier when we were talking that you wanted to lean down a little bit for switching sports from rowing to CrossFit and competing more there. How is that going to change your carnivore diet?
Well, I mean, obviously there's a period where, like I said, I started this around 240 pounds, and I'm going to get down to around 225, and I'm about most of the way there already. So that was just me doing, kind of a eating leaner cuts of meat, adding some more fish in there. And then I do some fat cycling. So I'll do that for, 4 or 5 days, and I'll add some fat back in so I don't completely tank my hormones and that sort of stuff. So I kind of, do that for a period of time. And then once I get down to where I need to be, I'll figure out what my maintenance level is. I'll have to experiment a little bit. It'll probably be a kind of a mixture between the two. And then once you maintain a body weight for 6 months or so and a level of leanness, it gets a lot easier to maintain that. So it's just a matter of getting there and then maintaining it for a long enough period of time to where it kind of becomes your new baseline. Like, I've maintained 240 pounds for 10 years after having previously been 280 pounds for 20 years. And so, you just got to get there and then maintain it long enough. And you might have to continue to do what got you there for a period of time. And then once you're there, it sort of becomes your new normal, and then it's hard to move it. Then you have to try really hard to move the needle or move it a little farther. But I mean, as far as CrossFit goes, I'll just have to see and adjust depending on what my output's like. I mean, right now I'm training you know, pretty decent, pretty hard, you know, several times a day, and so far no problem keeping up. So we'll see if I have to make any further adjustments.
Excellent. And one last question. Do you check your blood glucose or get labs once a year, or how do you monitor things like insulin or blood glucose, lipid panel, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, I've done that periodically. I'll probably do that again once I kind of get down to this new baseline. You know, it makes sense. I don't like to do that in the middle of a change, you know, like when you're actively losing weight, because there's all kinds of things that go on that are in flux, particularly blood lipids. Blood lipids can fluctuate dramatically during weight loss. So it's kind of a, you know, not that helpful metric. And quite honestly, I tend to be more concerned about actual disease than risk markers, just because actual disease is what we're trying to mitigate and prevent. And so I look at things like the coronary artery calcium scan, which I tested mine 2 years into the diet, and it was a perfect zero. So no calcification whatsoever in any of my arteries in my heart, which is, you know, basically perfect. I like things like waist to height ratio. Those are good. When I check my insulin sensitivity, my HOMA-IR score was 0.8, which is excellent insulin sensitivity, which uses your fasting insulin versus your fasting glucose. So you combine those numbers. My lipid numbers, quite honestly, my triglycerides were super low. They were like 53. My triglyceride HDL ratio was right around 1. My LDL cholesterol was a little bit elevated at like 140. But I'm not, you know, like I said, when we talked about at the beginning, I think we have to put that into context of the other things that are going around, you know, as what is actual risk versus what is actual disease. And so I'm more a fan of, you know, measuring things like carotid intermediate thickness, coronary artery calcium scan. VO2 max is another pretty good proxy measure for, you know, heart function. And, you know, my VO2 max right now is extremely good, you know, in the excellent range for not only my age category, but for all age categories. So I'm pretty pleased with, you know, what's going on here. I think one of the problems, we get too enamored, and I know as a naturopath or functional medicine doc, we use a lot of labs out there, but I think some of those labs you really have to be able to put into context, because there are some that are normal and some that are abnormal based on standard reference ranges, which may not apply in that particular person's individual situation. The same thing can be said of, you know, nutrient levels in the blood, just because we know that different baseline diets result in different requirements. And so I think that's something to keep in mind as we interpret these labs.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. And I'm glad you recommended those more advanced screenings that people can look into getting, especially if they're overly concerned and, you know, if they have had an unhealthy lifestyle and changed it recently or are changing it recently. And maybe they have a family history, but not always do we know our family history. So that's very helpful to, especially the VO2 max. I don't hear a lot of people talking about that for a marker for heart health. So that's something that I don't think enough people are talking about out there, maybe more in the fitness community, but not so much crossing over into optimizing heart health or.
Yeah. I mean, you can look at, there's, you know, the Cooper Clinic, and you can look at some of the tests there, look at, you know, cardiac function. And we know that a heart and lungs that can do a lot tend to be healthier. There's exceptions to that. I mean, there's people that are fit to die, certainly, but by and large, the majority of the people that are very fit have healthier hearts, yeah, as a general rule.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Well, this has been spectacular, and I thank you for your time and everything you shared with us. You did mention your website, so I will repeat that for the audience again. It's meetrx.com. And you mentioned that on there's coaching and some other resources, correct?
Right. Yeah, we've got all kinds of research, all sorts of research. We've got hundreds and hundreds of articles. Dr. Phil Avadia, who's a cardiothoracic surgeon, has been curating that library, putting just hundreds and hundreds of research articles talking about some of the stuff I talk about. We've got all kinds of recipes, you know, for ways to do different meat and animal-friendly products, you know, for those who want to be more creative. We have just all kinds of meetings for individual tailored to different groups, whether it's diabetes or obesity or anxiety or women's group or exercise or, you know, binge eating disorder or whatever. We've got all kinds of support groups in there. We've got, you know, links to the environmental arguments. You can, if you want to, get into that stuff. We've got hundreds and hundreds of articles on the environmental impact of meat, what the true stuff is, not the vegan propaganda. We've got, you know, again, the coaching is just incredibly affordable. We've got well-trained coaches. I've trained every one of them. We've got about 60 coaches right now, I think maybe 65, that are certified, that are there to help walk people through the diet and help them and support them and you know, give them some accountability. You know, it's not so much the knowledge, because, you know, you can get the knowledge anywhere. I mean, sometimes people need more than knowledge. They need support. They need a support system. They need someone that will, you know, help them through questions, and when they run into issues, help them overcome those things. And it's a time saver, really, because you can, you know, it's like, I've been an athlete my whole life, and I know when I get a coach, I'm not going to waste a year. You know, I'm going to get to the results a lot faster. And so sometimes that can be a benefit. It's a time saver, and ultimately can be a money saver for a lot of people.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with that. I have some of my patients work with a health coach in some scenarios too. And you can tell when people are really ready to change, they're ready to work with a coach because they're not going to mess around like you're talking about. And you're also on social media, YouTube, Sean Baker, and Instagram, Sean Baker 1967, and that's Twitter. Correct.
Twitter, S Baker MD. Yeah. So those are okay. The three major sort of areas that I hang out, but I'm, like I said, MeetRx every day. I do a live meeting on video with Zoom, and we have a Zoom meeting. We have anywhere from, you know, 40 to 100 people in that meeting, just asking questions and sharing stories. And it's just quite a lot of fun. I really enjoy it.
That's spectacular. Awesome. Well, I'm going to check it out, and I recommend it to the listeners, especially if this has spurred you to have more questions and you're still contemplating if the carnivore diet can help you. And again, thank you so much, Sean. Thanks for your time. And everybody, go follow Sean on all those social media places and go to MeetRx.
Yeah, let me just add one other thing, Sam.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
We also have a physicians portal on MeetRx. So we have about 100 physicians on the site that kind of share their experience with patients and some of the science and research. So if you're a physician or healthcare provider that's interested in interacting with other healthcare providers that are experiencing, you know, using this, you know, as a tool to, you know, help with their patients. That is a place to go that we have. So we've got that. It's been well received so far.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, I'm going to check that out too then. And thanks for mentioning that. Well, everybody, thanks for listening today. And please share this podcast with friends and family. And we'll see you next time. Take care. Now, here's for my mandatory disclaimer. This is a medical information podcast and is only for general information purposes. It does not substitute or constitute the practice of medicine or any medical practices, including the giving of medical advice to any individual. And please observe that no doctor-patient relationship has been formed here. This medical podcast offers health, hormone, fitness, and nutrition information and is designed for educational purposes only. You should not rely on this information as a substitution for, nor does it replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have any concerns or questions about your health, you should always consult with a physician or other healthcare professional. Do not disregard, avoid, or delay obtaining medical or health-related advice and appropriate treatment from your healthcare professional. Users should seek the care of their physician or healthcare professional for any such conditions. The use of any information provided on this podcast is solely at your own risk. The contents and topics of this podcast have not been evaluated by the FDA nor approved by any other government or official body. The topics and content covered is not intended to diagnose, cure, or prevent any disease or disorder of any kind. Developments in medical research may impact the health, fitness, and nutritional advice that appears here on the podcast in the future episodes. No assurance can be given that the advice contained in this podcast will always include the most recent findings or developments in medicine with respect to the particular material covered. If you are in the United States and think you are having a medical or health emergency, call your healthcare professional or 911 immediately. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to hearing your feedback and
looking forward to have you on future podcasts. Thank you.